Greek term biblos defines the bark of the papyrus plant on which many of the ancient peoples wrote their letters and their books. Hence, Biblia means books, and our word Bible simply designates a collection or anthology of books. Now, in the West, the word Bible has come to signify a collection of sacred books. By the Bible, we designate the Torah and the books of the prophets and the holy writings which comprise our Hebrew scripture. Now, Christian neighbors mean by the word Bible the Hebrew scriptures and their New Testament. One could equally well say that the Quran was the Bible of Islam, the Tripitaka was a Bible of Buddhism. The word Bible then describes a work's significance and not its substance. It describes a book which a particular culture venerates and holds sacred, to which it turns as the ultimate definer of truth. When a culture truly believes in its Bible, when the Bible is vibrant, it is enough for a lawyer or for a statesman or for a preacher to follow out his line of argument and to cap it off to prove what he is saying by an apt and a quotation from scriptures. The Bible is assumed to be the very necessary basis of educational curriculum. And it is obviously in the people's psyche assumed to have a certain kind of power or aura about it. And so we place our hand on the Bible as we take an oath of public office. We place our hand on the Bible as we promise to speak the truth in a court of law. And our brides bring a Bible to the altar as a sign of the consecrated meaning, the deep, lasting meaning of this moment. If one wants to understand any of the great cultures of mankind, one of the best keys to such understanding lies in the Bible, its Bible. For the Bible offers to that culture the idiom, the language, the series of values, the priorities, which in one way or another it makes its own. But we must be very careful when we read a Bible to read it with the eyes of a devotee, of a native, of one who believes, and not with the pejorative eyes of an outsider, of a critic, who is prepared to look at the book only in terms of its appeal to him, given his own frame of reference, his own prejudices and preconceptions. God knows that we Jews have reason to understand this. For how often have we been told by those raised in rather traditional Christian terms that in our Bible we are commanded to worship a zealous and rather fearsome God who once chose this people to be his own, but whose prophets brought word which because of our sins made us forever alien to our God, and that these very prophecies are not so much moral statements for the people, but they are prefigurations of the coming of the Messiah, the coming of the Christ. Now, a new Bible has appeared in the last 20 years in our world. This Bible, a little red book which bears as its title quotations from Chairman Mao Zedong. This fact alone is of significance. For when a people, 600 to 700 million strong, adopt a Bible, make a text the very basis of their lives, everyone else in the world would do well to understand the ideas around which this nation, this people, and their adherents beyond its borders are forming their lives. And I begin with this word of warning about the cultural perspective we bring to this Bible or to any Bible. because as I have read our more popular press, I find this Bible described only critically, almost as a devil's Bible, as a pernicious and vicious book. Many snide words are spoken about its hard-headed realism. Said the realism is called belligerency. Mao here says that war is a legitimate means of carrying out a political mission. In this book, he makes the distinction between what he calls a just war and an unjust war. And he defines just and unjust in self-serving terms. A just war is a war which serves the interests of the progressive peoples, of the masses, of the Communist Party. An unjust war is a war which opposes those interests, and he proclaims the interest of his party in participating in any and all just wars. And Americans who read this book are particularly put off because in it we are the enemy, Belial, Satan. Workers of the world unite against the imperialist America and all of its running dogs. Now, it's very easy to find much to criticize in such ideas. They're hardly elevating, however realistic many may feel them to be. But it is well to remember, before we condemn, that our own Bible, the Bible of Western man, the Bible which no one looks upon as a belligerent document, commands that when the children of Israel are to enter the promised land, they are to destroy utterly the people therein, they are to make no treaty with them, and they are to show them no mercy. And that in this Bible, there is, in our Bible, there is in fact a discussion of a milchemet rashut, of a just war, or a possible war, a milchemet chovah, a war of obligation, a just war. But over time, people have understood that the Bible contains so much else. And we have allowed this early period of the Judges with its belligerency to disappear from our conception. And we know that the Bible teaches, seek ye peace and pursue it. It gives us a vision of an end of time when every man shall sit under his vine and under his fig tree, and none shall make him afraid, for they shall have beaten the swords into plowshares and the spears into pruning hooks. And so we read the Bible with different eyes, but if one came to the Bible critically, one could find in the Word of God quite as much as one finds in the Word of Chairman Mao. Belligerency, aggressiveness, and bellicosity. What then does this book talk about? What is its basic terms and frame of reference? What are its ideas? In the first instance, it's designed to be a Bible. It's a series of discrete quotations taken from the rather voluminous writings of Chairman Mao Tse-tung, grouped around 33 topical headings. The first of these are the Communist Party and classes and class war, and the last of these are youth, women, culture and art, and study. It deals with almost all of the aspects of life in terms of quotations taken over a period of 20 or 30 years from the writing of the man whose picture smiles at you benignly from the frontispiece of the book. This is designed to be a Bible. It is designed to be a book which the young Chinaman will pick up, take with him. You've all seen pictures of the Chinese youth cadres smiling at the photographer, each one clutching the Bible in its hand. They are to read these quotations, they are to discuss them, to memorize them, to chant some of them. They are to use them as the basis of constant discussion with their colleagues in their cadres and in their groups. And these ideas are to provide what Mao calls the ideological self-reformation, in other words, the self-improvement of the soul and of the mind of his followers. When you open the book, almost as you might when you open a Bible, you find that just before the table of contents, Lin Biao, the heir designate, the favorite disciple of Chairman Mao, has this one quotation. Study Chairman Mao's writings, follow his teachings, and act according to his instructions. And a Jew can't help but think of the phrase from our rabbis, Hafoch Bei Vafoch Bei Dekulibo, turn the Bible over and turn the Bible over for you'll find everything in it. Or the great line from Psalms with which we return the scroll to its ark this morning. Behold, a good doctrine has been given unto you, forsake it not. This, in other words, is a curriculum vitae, a guide through life. And the young Chinese who picks up the book of quotations, his little red books, picks it up with a particular veneration. He's prepared to deal with it as his Bible, because it is the word of his leader. Bibles tend to be formed around the words of a particularly successful leader, Moses, Muhammad, Gautama, the Buddha, Confucius. Men who by the force of their lives as well as by the quality of their lives validate the teachings that they speak. Mao's writings are not simply the writings of another socialist ideologue. They are the writings of a man who brought about for China the most radical reformation in the millennial history of that people. He is the man who held together his followers during the long march of several thousand miles from the eastern seaboard deep into the interior in the days of the Japanese invasion when Chiang Kai-shek and the Japanese were fighting against this kind of revolution, who by sheer force of will and by idea and by doctrine welded these once beaten people into a successful revolutionary movement. They pick up this book as the doctrine of a George Washington and as a doctrine of a Lenin, a man who not only organizes a successful revolution, but manages it to further success so that it makes good on its pledges. China emerged from the Second World War into its own revolution. It wasn't until the late 1940s that the present Peking government gained power. The China in which they gained power was abysmally poor, suffered from malnutrition by the hundreds of millions of people suffered from malnutrition, from illiteracy. There was very little industry or communication. And in the last 20, 25 years, Mao, by the force of his ideas and of his personality, has brought about a truly incredible revolution. There is now almost enough for everyone to eat. There is now industry, there is now transportation, there is now almost universal literacy. All that in the briefest period of time. So like Moses, who brought the children of Israel from bondage to the promised land, so Mao has brought them from bondage to the past, bondage to foreign aggression, bondage to the warlords and to the old Mandarin class, to the promised land where there seems to be a new freedom economically and socially. They are prepared to believe what's in this book, and that's what makes it a Bible. The Chinese traditional way of thought has been inductive. Not to believe that the word is brought through some messenger of God, from God to man, but that the word, the truth, is gained by man by going out into the world and looking on the world as it is, indirect, in real life, and then inducing from his experience with his mind what he can of a general formulation about how man must live. Confucius centuries ago said, when you look at the world, look at it without preconception and without predilection, without prejudice. Don't assume you know what life is about until you've gone out and lived it. Mao says here, all knowledge is gained through direct experience. Don't try and think superficially, subjectively. Go out and study. Go out and find. So this Bible is, and this is surprising to many in the West, is not a catechism. It's not an ideology in the sense that all is stated for you of the truth. You have only to memorize and ingest what is given. Rather, what Mao insists is that there is a correct form of analysis. One must always go out into the world and find out what the world is about. But then the Marxist-Leninist ideology allows you to understand, to give shape to what you are seeing. And what you are seeing is always what they call the existence of contradictions, what we in the West sometimes call the paradoxical quality of life. Life is always in process, but there are always two parties to that process, a constructive one, a conservative or destructive one. There's always tension between them. There is always the dialectic. But ultimately, the conservative must give way to change, and that change must always be progressive. And so we find in this a truth. But the truth is not one of simple statement. Rather, it's a truth which insists that there is one and only one way at looking at that confusion we call life in order to give it order, and that's what all human thought is about. And the only way one can look at the world is through the analytical system, with the dialectic mechanisms, which Marx and Lenin and the other communist ideologists have taught us to use. So you find here constantly the emphasis, go out and look. Have no preconceptions, but there is an implicit preconception, and that is the preconception of the Marxist system of analysis. There are other preconceptions. There is the assumption that between the corporate group and the individual, it is the corporate group, it is the society, it is the party, it is the cadre where the emphasis must be placed. The individual gains in this form of thinking his dignity by participating in the goals of the group. He is nothing outside of his society. He must always sacrifice himself for the well-being of the totality. Yes, throughout, Mao uses the word democracy. He's interested in conversation, in debate within the party structure. He has no patience with what he calls intellectual elitism, the so-called expert who comes and tells you what you need to know without investigating the actual conditions as they are. But he always uses the word democracy in this context, a proper measure of democracy as opposed to what he calls ultra-democracy. Now, a proper measure of democracy means democracy within the cadre. You can talk, and you are encouraged to talk up and to tell to the group your frustrations, what you think the group needs, why you think someone is abusing his power. But you can do so only within the context of what is assumed to be the direction the revolution, the factory, the commune must take. Individualism, liberalism, what we would call today in our jargon doing your own thing, is an ultimate sin, because one has no thing outside of the group. As I read through these quotations, I was often reminded of the rhetoric and the system of values of some of the old New England divines, Richard Mather, Cotton Mather, and the like. For there is here the insistence on utter selflessness, the words are Mao's, on sacrificing oneself for the group, the words are Mao's, of having no set of goals which are those of greed as opposed to those which are of the common good, the words are Mao's. There is a condemnation of all that is self-indulgence, all that deals with the appetite, all that deals with grossness and greed. There is the gospel of hard work. He constantly tells young people in this book to put their shoulder to the wheel, not to believe that the revolution has been won. The real struggle is only now beginning to transform the nature of man and the nature of Chinese and human society. Have you ever wondered why it is that we sometimes hear and see pictures of groups of Western young people under that ubiquitous picture of Chairman Mao with a little red book in their hands, chanting his praises? Obviously, some of it has to do with a blind rage against themselves, their parents, their world, and Mao in China represents everything that will make their parents, you know, climb up the proverbial pole. But more than that, there is in this teaching another doctrine opposite to our own. which has a great deal of appeal to it, and which must be considered in its own terms. Against the alienation of Western man, against what we sometimes call the dehumanization of our society, against the walls that we build between ourselves and our neighbors, because each of us is after his own purposes, is following his own star, is seeking to gain advantage over all others in order that he can do his thing, Mao gives the preachment of a society which is devoted, totally devoted to the common good, to the brotherhood, where everyone is a comrade. He speaks constantly of what he calls the development of a common language. And he means by that that when each of us walks his own way, we speak our own tongue, we have our own set of priorities, we're always watching our words. But when we are wholly devoted to the common good, whether it be the productive capacity of a factory, whether it be the agricultural output of a farm, whether it be the proper education of young people in our school, then we become open with those who are working with us. We're not afraid of sharing our thoughts, our feelings, our aspirations. He quotes an old Chinese description by Lao Tzu, the founder of Taoism, to the effect that most men live cheek by jowl with their neighbors, so close they can hear their neighbor's rooster crow, they can hear their neighbor's dog bark, but they can't talk to their neighbor. They lack a common language because each is seeking his own survival and not the common good. And so by self-criticism, by openness, by avoidance of gossip, by avoidance of backbiting, all of them sins described in this book, by learning to share, to work, to subordinate our own interests to the interests of the group from which our own interests are ultimately made secure, Mao insists we can come to a new degree of cooperation, of participation, of openness in human relationships. And he is constantly involved in developing a society which will be open and free, a society which will have in it not men who are specialists. This man is not a human being, but he is a lawyer. This man is not a human being, but he is the doctor. This man is not a human being, but we define him as the teacher. But a place in which all men will, in a sense, share a wholesome life, a complete kind of existence. The doctor must go out and work in the countryside with his hands. The intellectual must go into the factory and work at the machine. Every man must be trained. The peasant must turn to books, go to school. Every rural commune must have its cultural hall where the great world without can be brought to him. All men must, in a sense, share what is the common humanity, the common experience, so that we avoid a kind of intellectual classism. And the schools of China, he says, must be devoted to creating the human being, the complete human being, who is open, who understands not only what's in the world of books, not only his privileged role as an intellectual within society, but what it means to work on the farm, what it means to work in the factory, what it means to work with as a poor man among the poor. He talks of the complete man. He talks of an open society. He talks of a society in which each man shares common purposes and works for the common good. He talks a language which Chinese understand and with which they instinctively empathize, because he is seeking to remove some of the age-old injustices of that social order. Mao was raised in the home of a petty tyrant. His father was what he would call an upper peasant. He had a few dollars. He had a little bit of land. He had the old Confucian values. He lived on the edge of poverty, but he was one step above it. His father beat the boy to a bloody pulp. His father tyrannized the mother. His father was the autocrat of the breakfast table and the lunch table and the dinner table and of everything else that happened in that house. He must have been a terrible, terrible man. But as Mao came to analyze his father, he recognized that he was not simply a cruel human being, but he was the product of his own environment, of a cruel, brutalizing, cannibalistic society. If the father did not have autocratic control of the sons, of the children, of the defense of the family, of the farm, the whole family would have fallen back down into that abysmal pit, which was rural poverty, which meant starvation, death. The father had inherited all of the old Chinese attitudes, which kept women subservient, kneeling in their place. He thought nothing of tyrannizing the wife because he needed from the women in the family absolute obedience. They had to do a man's work and more. There had to be a single source of control. Understanding his own family, he came to understand what he feels is the basic hope of life. One of the surprising things about this little red book is the almost exuberant, exultant tone with which it faces the future. I know of no book in the West in recent times which is as confident of progress of tomorrow as Mao's book is. He speaks constantly of the bright new future. He promises that this bright new future is inevitable. The course of history is irreversible. It's guaranteed. And when it comes, it will come about because the social and economic conditions which surround the peasant, the Chinese, have so changed. Instead of being brutalized and debased as was his father, they have been raised in a society which allows them to open up, to release the human resource of spirit and heart and mind. And he talks exultantly of what the masses will become as society permits them to turn into truly human and humane animal human beings. This is the theme that runs throughout. The new China is unlike the old, not simply in that there is greater economic productivity, not simply is that there is now an agricultural surplus, not simply that there are good roads and quick means of communication throughout China, but because the Chinese who will develop will be a new breed, a better human being. They will have had the possibility of developing their sensitivities, their humanity, because the world in which they live, the spirit of cooperation in which they live, the educational opportunities which are theirs, the sense of common purpose which will make it unnecessary for them to be on their guard always against everyone else as we are in our competitive society. All this will allow the emergence of a magnificent human person. That's what he describes here. It is almost a Rousseau-esque belief in the decency of man himself, the potential dignity of all men, the capacity of all men. He looks upon greed and competition and aggressiveness and violence as if they are only conditioned reactions, our ways of defending ourselves in a society which forces us always on the defensive. But allow a society to be created in which we can be open, in which we can share, in which we feel that we can be in a relationship of comradeship with all others. And these defenses which are inbred in us will no longer be necessary. We will emerge as finer, more spirited, you wouldn't use the word, but more spiritual human beings. And that's the vision. And that's the reason that this book appeals. And that's how it is read within China. Not as a book which proclaims war against imperialistic America, but as a book which proclaims hope for a people which has been benighted and deprived for centuries. And if there must be war with the West, no one wants war, Mao says, even for a day. War will come only because the West is aggressive and imperialist, it's holding back the inevitable change of times. It's creating a character, you and I, who are by nature aggressive. We've been trained in this kind of social order, who will never be satisfied with their lot, who will always want more. So it must be deemed aggressive, imperialistic, and must be dealt with as such. What of the book? Is it a good book? Is it a hopeful book? Simply a book. history of Bibles is this, that their value depends upon what a society needs of the book and how it uses the book. The problem which faces the Chinese future, as they will turn to Mao's little red book again and again, is, I think, a parallel to the problem which faced the early Christian church as it dealt with its evangel, its teaching of hope. Jesus had preached that the kingdom of God is at hand. Mao preaches that the kingdom of socialism is at hand. Mao, however, is far more realistic than the Christian gospel in that he knows and says constantly that there is a long, long period of change where we must be on our guard, where we must move the society forward, where we must see that there are the controls within the society, within the state, which forces the change which we know to be necessary. But the question in both cases is, how do you organize life in the interim? What happens until the second coming? What happens until the apparatus of the state can wither away and the true socialist paradise be here? There's a quotation in this book in where the rhetorical question is asked and answered. Do we want the power of the state to disappear? Yes. Why does it not disappear? Because the time is not yet here. When will the time be? When we are no longer threatened by aggressive imperialism without, by domestic conservatism and within, by social unrest. But the time is not yet. And until then, the apparatus of the state, the apparatus of the army, and the apparatus of the party must be strengthened. Now, the history of human institutions is the history of frustration with institutions. You create a party, you create a state, you create a church for the period between now and the coming. And the now is endless. And the state grows in power over your lives. China's future will in large degree be determined by whether or not the human transformation occurs, and then those in control of that transformation are truly willing to abide the teachings of Mao and allow the power to go to the people and allow the people to co-opt corporately within the context of their own society to make up their minds for themselves. But whatever it is or is not, this book is not simple-minded. It is not merely belligerent. It is a book which has a doctrine of man and a messianic doctrine and an ethic and one of quite high order within it. And we in the West do well to recognize that many of the things we don't like in this book, we act on in any case. We may not like to think about war as an instrument of political activity. But what else is Vietnam? What else was Korea? We may not like to think of the need for corporate order, but can we really carry on with this kind of society in which everyone is walking in his own direction and there seems no longer to be a center? There seems no longer to be the capacity of the society to make the changes which are necessary to move forward. Would we not in some ways be better off for a sense of corporate responsibility? And do we not ultimately, when all of our glorification of competition and free enterprise, capitalism and so on is set aside, do we not ultimately recognize that nothing we have, however wealthy we be, is secure unless the society itself is stable and secure, and that nothing that we really are is ours innately, but the society created the conditions in which we were educated, the family created the conditions in which we learned of value and the ability to love. We are in a large degree what others have permitted us to be, and if we are not satisfied with what we have become or what others are becoming, then perhaps ought we not to take another look at the institutions of our society and ask what kind of man they are truly intended to produce. I don't want to overstate the case. This is not ultimate truth. These are the thoughts of a successful revolutionary who has seen human brutality, who has brutalized men, who has seen a revolution become successful at the cost of millions of lives and did not qualm to expend these lives. A man who has had ultimate power and has used that power to its ultimate limits of possibility. He is just another man. And he is not a foolish, and he's not simply a pathological dictator. He's a man with a vision. He's a remarkably rational human being. He's well-read. He was once a librarian and a school teacher. He has thought through what he says. And if he says it rather prosaically and pedantically, he says things which we ought to be thinking about. For millions and millions of people are thinking about his thoughts, forming their lives about him. Amen.